I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. If you think the South is just about slavery, the Civil War, plantations, the KKK, Jim Crow, and Confederate statues, you don't know the whole story. Our guest, Imani Perry, who was born in Birmingham, Alabama, and lives in Philadelphia, decided to travel through the South to see what she could find about the place she still calls home. Her new book, South to America, is about a complex and contradictory region that reveals a lot about the rest of the country. In fact, she says you can't really understand America until you understand the South, especially when it comes to matters of race. She writes that she faced the most vicious racism while living in Boston, not in Birmingham, which was once called the most racist city in the country. Imani Perry is the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and joins us once again on Radio Times. Imani Perry, nice to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. This book is about a place where you were born. You lived until you were about 5 years old. Those, of course, are very formative years. Do you still feel like a Southerner in your bones, in your heart, in your soul?
I do. You know, one of the I read a quotation once from Romare Bearden, the great African-American painter, and he left. I actually left a little bit younger, like 3 and a half, and he left North Carolina around the same age. I went to Milwaukee initially and then to Boston, and he said he used to say he only ever left Carolina physically.
Wow.
And I really feel the same way. There's this sense of sort of, I think, you know, the place where you learn to walk, talk, read, dance, that's home. And for many people, and certainly for me, and my family has always been a Southern family. I do not come from a great migration family, so my family is there. So it's absolutely home.
You write a lot about home, using the word home, which on the one hand can feel like a very simple idea, but I get the feeling for you, home is a very complicated word and idea.
It is. I mean, and I think this is a matter of the personal, but also as a function of identity, you know, so there's no, it's not incidental that in Toni Morrison's classic Beloved, that sweet home is the place where all of this violence occurred, that home is a vexing concept for African Americans in this country. So that this location, this region, which was the site of so much devastation, is also the site of incredible beauty and creativity and resilience. And so for me, the concept of home is not, it can't be a simple one because of what this country has been and how resistant in so many eras it has been to the idea that for Black Americans, this is our home.
Your book has the title about the Mason-Dixon line, which, you know, it's interesting to think of it both as a literal line today, but also as a figurative line. And there was a Mason-Dixon line, and in fact, it was essentially between Maryland and Pennsylvania. And since we're talking in Pennsylvania, exactly, I mean, how should we think about the Mason-Dixon line today?
I mean, I think it's... Of course, it has its symbolic meanings, but I think there's something, at least for me, that was really instructive about realizing that it's not that far from here. Mm-hmm. Because symbolically, when we think of the South, we're usually thinking about like cotton country, right? When we talk about what the South is, we're talking about, you know, that the Black Belt, right? That's the major symbol of the South. But of course, the South is created in movements that had to do with both the environment, the physical environment, and, you know, how the land was used to create prosperity. So for me, it helped me, thinking about the literal line, helped me think about the South not in terms of a fixed concept that came from my identity as someone who was born in the Deep South, but actually just think about it as something that was facilitated the creation of the nation, the prosperity that came from tobacco and sugar and, of course, cotton. That was what fed the wealth production of this country. So I think it's the spatial part is important because it helps us think differently about how the nation came to be outside of the mythologies.
And my understanding is Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, I'm sure others were enslaved in Maryland, right? They were not enslaved
right.
in Alabama or Mississippi.
Right. Yeah, right. And I, you know, it's so funny because I've known that, right? Obviously, because I teach in African American studies. But when I lived in Maryland, I never thought of it as the South. And that was one of the early encounters in the book, is to think, oh, wait, this is... So it's sort of, there's this gap between what I knew intellectually of the history of Maryland and what I felt, right, my own sensibility. And that's part of what I was challenging. Although I will say, when I took my sons to see the Harriet Tubman movie, and at the towards the beginning, Harriet Tubman's sisters are being sold away to Alabama, and there's this great weeping. And I said to them, you know, this is when this moment is profound, because that's where our people are from, right? So the thing that is so horrifying in Tubman's life is the prospect of her sisters being where we came from. So that they, you know, as a way of helping them understand the kind of extraordinary suffering, but also resilience that they descend from, being, you know, the child of an Alabaman.
Let me quote something from your book. You write, paying attention to the South, its past, its dance, its present, its threatening future, and most of all, how it moves the rest of the country about, allows us to understand much more about our nation and about how our people, land, and commerce work in relation to one another, often cruelly. That's just one sentence that I pulled out of the book. But yeah. Do you think people in the North, and you know, I grew up in Massachusetts, I'm, you know, sort of a Yankee at heart in many ways. That's where I feel like I'm most at home, but that we do not understand the South, and we judge the South in a way that to our detriment.
I think that's right. I mean, so part of what happens, and you know, so I had my education mostly in Massachusetts. So my formal education, my sense of the nation beginning is 1620, right? And it's very, you know, it's even when I went to graduate school, we spent the first year studying the Puritans in history of American civilization course. And so every region has its sort of biases in terms of its narration of the nation based upon the identity of that place. I think the cost is that it's so easy to have the South be the place that is seen as having done all of the bad things without realizing that the production of wealth in New England, especially a place like Rhode Island, for example, had everything to do with enslavement and had everything to do, or the Revolutionary War, right? So the paying off the Revolutionary War debt was, it had to be Southern states that did that. That's why D.C. is where it is. Or, you know, there's example after example, the United States becoming a global power because of the exploitation of unfree labor. The relationship to, you know, to the Caribbean and to Latin America, and all of these things have been shaped by what happened in the South, right? From slavery through Jim Crow. And so there's, and certainly places like New York, you know, Wall Street beginning as a slave market and Lehman Brothers beginning as a cotton exchange. So there's a way that when we leave out those parts of the story, what can be left is just, oh, here's this glorious narrative of remarkable success in these other regions, but we're not like those bad people down there. But wait a minute, those conditions are what allowed all of this prosperity and wealth to be produced. And so pushing aside attention to that history comes at very great cost to us. I mean, it's not just that it's wrong, but it makes us not attentive to the cruelties that we don't see today, right? So I think we tell the story more accurately so that we can be better people in relationship to others. You know, that's the ultimate goal.
Well, indeed. And I have to say, and I mentioned the fact that I grew up in Massachusetts, and just a personal, very quick little story here. Moved when I was 8 years old with my family to Delaware. So I lived in rural Massachusetts. Mm. I never saw a black person. We moved to Delaware, to a segregated town where there was, you know, the blacks, black people sat upstairs at the movie theater. The schools were segregated. And in hindsight, and maybe today, I feel like that was the real America. The Massachusetts I lived in was not the real America. It was lovely, beautiful, but not the real America. But this Southern Delaware town was the real America.
Yeah. And, you know, that's so profound, but I would say one of the experiences I had in a small town in Massachusetts as a child, and it's actually hard for me to talk about. I think I was like 6 or 7 years old, and I went to a pool and got in the pool, and all of the, like a public, you know, community pool, and all of the other kids got out. And what was so profound is not, you know, sort of the feeling. I had already been socialized not to have my feelings hurt. But what I realized is that in that place, the kids had already been taught, right, even without Black people around, that I was to be avoided. And to think how profound it is that children get taught that at a tiny age, even when Black people aren't around, I mean, it's harrowing, you know, in retrospect. Because I doubt anybody had said to them explicitly,
well, exactly,
stay away from Black kids in the pool, right? So the power of those lessons, the way they seep into our culture, is really dramatic.
Well, and a fair amount of your book is about growing up in the South, about your grandmother that I mentioned, and just what a powerful influence she was on you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just an extraordinary woman who when I was recording the audiobook, I would just break down on the sections about her. I miss her so much all the time. And she had a kind of resilience and self-regard that is an absolute model, I think, for me personally. But honestly, it's a lesson for anybody who exists in a position where they are diminished or seen as inferior. I mean, the way the external world evaluated her did not shape her self-conception. She had just incredible dignity and grace and confidence in her ability to assess the world, and she was assertive. And that tradition is absolutely what facilitated, the civil rights movement. She's older than the civil rights generation, but she's this reminder. There were people who invested in the development of communities such that a generation could come up that would transform the world. Just amazing person.
And she was clearly a part of that. Imani, we're going to take a very short break, and I'd love to have you read a section from your book about your grandmother. But let me just quickly reintroduce you and talking with Imani Perry once again on Radio Time. She's been a guest on the show numerous times over the years, and she's the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. And we're talking about her new book. It's called South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation. And you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone to join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Imani Perry about her new book, South to America. She was born in Alabama and is now professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. And she writes in this book that to understand America, you have to understand the South. Imani, I'd love to have you read a section. It's on page 154 about your grandmother.
Okay, sure. She would sit there in the kitchen, small and solid. She hated gluttony and ate on a saucer, or sometimes out of a small bowl. Her newspaper would be in front of her, and she proceeded deliberately through life until it was over. I always studied her hands and her voice. Her ring fingernails were ridged like mine. Her beds were wider. I can still call them up in my mind's eye. I liked to stand behind her chair in the mint green kitchen as she ate or drank coffee. As a little girl, I would say it this way in competition with my cousins, elbowing them to the side. I want her back. which is now, years after her death, true in another way. As she lived, I sucked down every story she ever told me about her life, wrote them down over and over, so much so that now they are imprinted not just in my mind, but in my fingers, a muscle memory.
I mean, that's so lovely. And this double entendre, I want her back. You wanted to stand yes. behind her. And now, of course, you want her back.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, I think there's a kind of, for me, there's a meaning behind sort of invoking her in this book. We have, you know, there's a particular role that grandmothers have in Black cultures, period, and in Black Southern culture in particular, that they are like often called, you know, Big Mama, or, you know, kind of the mother of the whole family, that there's a kind of expansiveness to the grandmother role. And many of us live with our grandmothers as young people. And so, but I wanted to see her not just as a sort of caretaker, but as a guide to sort of returning to this place that I departed from. So wanting her back is also like using is not the right word, but like sort of seeing her as the person who I continue to interpret the world through.
What did you call her? What was the name that you called your grandma?
Madia, yeah, which is a contraction for, mostly known now because of Tyler Perry movies, but for of Mother Dear, that's common.
That's common, yeah, that's really nice. And you wanted her back as a little girl so that you could see what she could see?
Yes, and proximity. I wanted to be as physically close to her as I possibly could. You know, I wanted to, and there's also a double entendre with her beds being wider because, you know, we had a big family. So literally the beds in the house were king size beds because multiple people would sleep in the bed. And I wanted to be right next to her all the time, like sort of cuddled up under her. Her nail beds were wider than mine, but her beds had so much capacity, and I like to still sleep in her bed this many years after she's passed. In fact, I was telling my younger son, I said, I'm going to Birmingham in March. Do you want to go? And he said, well, where are we going to be? And I said, you know, told him the hotel. And he said, well, I don't want to go if we're not going to Medea's house. That's where I want to stay.
Aww. You know, and sleep in one of those beds.
Know. Yes. Yes.
She raised 12 children, correct?
Yep. She raised 12 children. And many of us, too. You know, and I've written about it in earlier books, but the part of her resourcefulness was always being a resource. So many of us returned at various moments to live in the house with her. So she really, I mean, in some sense, even when my kids were tiny and she was an elderly woman, you know, if they were crying, she'd be like, give me, that baby's fretful, give him to me. And she, of course, could calm them down immediately. I mean, she just had a hand for nurturing children. It's remarkable.
It is remarkable. And it's wonderful to have those memories, as painful as they might be, to remember them at times. Let me go back to your book. And you begin in Harper's Ferry. That's where your journey begins. This is, of course, West Virginia, the site of the, John Brown uprising mm-hmm. that was ended in failure, if I can use that particular word. You write about a guy named Shields Green, the Emperor of New York.
Yeah.
Who was he?
Yeah, he's really interesting. He was a Black man who was part of John Brown's raid, who doesn't leave a first person account, right? So he's referred to by Frederick Douglass, and of course he was connected with John Brown, and he was executed with John Brown. And part of what I wanted to talk about with him is one that he's a really powerful contrast with Frederick Douglass, in the sense that, you know, Douglass is the most photographed man of the 19th century, and he is given this heroic quality, even at the time, notwithstanding, you know, the fact that he was an abolitionist. And Shields Green is talked about in really kind of ugly terms. You know, he's exceedingly Black, and he has a speech impediment, and there's a sort of disgust for him And he doesn't leave a record, but these clues that he was referred to as the Emperor of New York and are just a sign of what we don't know and what and the extraordinary people who have been sort of denigrated by the historical record. So for me, it's like I wanted to start in a place that revealed all of the sort of contradiction and complexity, right? West Virginia is a great example because it's created, because it secedes from Virginia, because it's pro-Union, and it's a site of that Harper's Ferry, but it's considered, you know, now this sort of very kind of lost cause state. But that's complicated too, because it has this incredible labor movement history. So there's all of the, and it has so many stereotypes. I mean, Appalachia is perhaps the most stereotyped part of the country. So Shields Green is this one person who, for me, opened up what it meant to sort of be, to refuse to let the settled story sit, you know. And I wanted that kind of as, to be part of the entry point, as well as the Confederate reenactor.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, and there is a Confederate reenactor that you spend about an hour talking with at Harper's Ferry. You know, seemed like a nice guy, if I can put it that way. And you're right, as skeptical as I was of why anyone would want to play act at preserving slavery, I was endeared to him. He was friendly. Also, I was intrigued by him. This was a man who had advanced degrees and a job that satisfied his passion for history, but somehow made him yearn for more. He wanted to live inside history, to know its nooks and crannies, to imagine the everyday. How did you struggle inside talking to him?
Well, you know, it was interesting because I had decided before going, or before even embarking on this book, that I would never be able to talk to Confederate reenactors, right? And I had something stuck in my craw about Tony Horowitz's Confederates in the Attic, in part because of it, because I was like, he's so romantic about them, and, you know, he was a lovely man, so... I had that feeling. And so I was sort of unnerved. And then, you know, the quiet part is actually very much a part of what it means to navigate the South, right? There's things that people don't touch. We're talking across the color line, as it were. Because if you touch them, if you open it up, it's not just going to be an unpleasant moment. It is because of the history of the movement and because of the history of defiance, it can be something very big, very quickly. And so it was actually this moment where I was sort of taken back into the ways of, you know, keeping things on the surface, which is absolute, but while also being able to connect, which is absolute. You know, black and white people have so much intimacy in the South and also so much deep political pain, conflict, right? And that is substantively what it is. And for me, it was also powerful because I'm like him. Right. In this sense, I want to get inside history physically all the time. Right. We're the same person dispositionally. And I don't know why he wants to be a Confederate, but I know that part. Right. And so it's just that that's the complexity. You know, that's the difficulty.
Well, in fact, you say, just to underscore what you said there, I didn't ask him about being a Confederate because I didn't want to hear what I thought would probably come. Talk about Northern aggression and heritage, apologetics for the violence of slave society, tales of loyal black people, and you go on from there. I mean, obviously you didn't have the conversation, but you assumed that's where it would have gone if you had asked that maybe more uncomfortable next question.
Yes. And I'll say this, there are several moments in the book where I'm very clear about making assumptions at the things that I don't want to ask about. I'm deliberate about exposing that, you know, so that I'm not, in those moments, it's not a recommendation, but it's about a kind of self-protectiveness that is also learned. I think it's part of Black Southern experience where you have a kind of anticipatory disposition because you have learned. But that there is an impediment there that eventually hopefully we can all work out. Mm. You know,
in fact, you say about a white taxi cab driver, you know, friendly person, but your caution, you know, you say, mm-hmm. I mean, this guy could be someone who would kill me.
Yeah, absolutely. And to say that, and at the same time also be able to feel something for him, thinking about, he was an elderly man. He had worked in the mines for 30 years, so he almost certainly had lung damage and vision damage, and was now driving as an elderly man around a city that was unfamiliar, and without question was vulnerable, and also knowing that the men like him were also sort of a part of the core, that kind of, like, I don't know what the language would be, but army of racial violence in Birmingham. And then also he was the man who wanted to make sure I got him to my auntie's house before he drove away.
Right.
That's complicated, but that's what it is. You know, that's what it is.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Imani Perry, and we're talking about her new book, South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation. And again, if you want to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You know, it, picking up on what you said in terms of sort of navigating the world as you do, having to have sort of multiple personalities. I mean, I think we all do to some degree, but mm-hmm. maybe multiple personalities depending on the context and the person and maybe the race and the age and the gender, mm-hmm. that you have to have more than a double consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's interesting because I think that it is, I mean, to go back to sort of the core, right, of what Du Bois described as double consciousness is a kind of, or Fanon described as third person consciousness, that I think just generally speaking, as a Black person, you have to sort of see yourself from the outside in as simply as a matter of self-protection, right? Like how to not, you know, make yourself too vulnerable in the world, and that's different based upon region and class, you know, so that it's not as though, and I think that's part of sort of the story of the book too, white Americans are by no means a monolith. And the constructions, the codes of race, you know, I tell a story about realizing I was in the wrong restaurant in Virginia, and there not being anything explicit, but I could feel it, right? And that if I, and so part of the point there was, if I were in places, you know, if I were in Boston or in Birmingham, I would know where not to go. And I made a mistake, and no one would say anything. Well, that's not exactly true. Certainly in Boston, people would say, will tell you if you're in the wrong neighborhood. But wow. But in terms of, but you know what I mean? Like there's you learn codes of places, the racial codes. And it was frightening to realize, oh, I violated a code because I don't know how to navigate the way race works in this particular location.
And by wrong restaurant, you looked around and you realized you were the only Black person there, and just something
yes.
felt either uncomfortable. Is it like
yeah.
people giving you subtle side looks, things like that?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was clear, you know, in a place, and because part of the, you know, one of the things that, you know, really does distinguish the South, even more than the Midwest, or the Midwest tends to be, people tend to be earnest and welcoming, but, you know, people talk, Black and white people talk to each other in the South all the time, right? And so I entered a space where no one was speaking to me. I was the only Black person, and that was a red flag, right? This was not a place that Black people tended to be, right? That was a piece of it. There was a chilliness that I felt. It was sort of like that some line had been crossed. But then when I left, I also wondered if there were black people cooking in the kitchen, because that could also be the case. And I think understanding the nuance of sort of the color line, the persistent color line, in the South, but also everywhere, is actually something that's really important. You know, you can, the feeling of not belonging somewhere doesn't have to be explicitly stated. It can be communicated silently.
Let me read, we're almost up in a break here, but let me read another sentence or two from your book. You write, if you think yes. mistakenly that American racism can be surmounted by integration, by people knowing each other, even loving each other, the history of the American South must teach otherwise. There is no resolution to unjust relations without a structural and ethical change. Can you, we have about a minute before we have to take another break. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there is so, you know, the plantation household was multiracial. I think we should also look at the example of gender, right? Men and women love each other deeply. That doesn't end patriarchy. The same thing is true of people across the borders of race. Love, intimacy does not eliminate racism or racial domination. We've had them all through Southern history.
That is Imani Perry, our guest today on Radio Times. Again, she's got a new book, South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation. And she teaches African-American studies at Princeton University. She has been a guest on Radio Times over the years, talking about a whole host of matters, including a book that she wrote not so long ago called, here we go, Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry, and Breathe, A Letter to My Sons. And again, to join our conversation, we want you to do that. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Imani Perry. She teaches African-American studies at Princeton University. And again, she's got a new book called South to America. Imani, picking up on what we were talking about right before the break, and this, of course, gets us into a whole discussion about critical race theory and, you know, how do we teach yeah. and how do we understand what our history is all about. And yeah. is there a concise answer to that? And I asked that. It's interesting. I saw something in Florida. Now, these are just bills, so they haven't passed yet. But nonetheless, a bill about teaching race, that if a student feels discomfort, quotations, that someone, maybe their parents would have a right to sue a teacher or a school district if their child is made uncomfortable learning about our history. How do we deal with that?
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely terrible. I think it really is the new McCarthyism. It's kind of all these bills that are suggesting a kind of surveillance, a kind of demonization of teachers. And I mean, I think one of the challenges is this, and I don't know how we get to the conclusion that I'm suggesting, but I do think we should get to it. Countries build mythologies and national narratives, and what we're experiencing now is a conflict over what our national narrative will be. And obviously, I am more supportive of one that allows for the study of race. But I also wonder if we wouldn't be better off, given that we have never stopped being in conflict around the ideas of who belongs, who doesn't, whether people should all really be equal or there should be hierarchies, whether everybody's value is roughly the same or that there are some people who are more American than others. I just wonder if we shouldn't actually teach that and let go of the mythology that, you know, we have the sort of ever more perfect union, deeply egalitarian truth. We have always been in a repeated cycle over who counts, who should work, who shouldn't, you know, who matters more or less. And that requires actual sort of confrontation with the underside of history. So I don't think the answer is just greater inclusiveness, although greater inclusiveness is important. I think we should talk about the fact that we have had a series of deep political conflicts since the very beginning of the country. And we probably will continue to do so.
Let me ask you about, and you write about this, you know, this idea that, that an enslaved person was considered two-thirds of a person. You push back on that. And in fact, part of this right. book is you look for an enslaved ancestor. In fact, you dedicate the book to her and to some other people, Esther, someone you wanted to find out more about. But this idea of someone having a name and being, you know, considered property and also having a complete system design about enslaving them. How do we think of that person as two-thirds when they had so much value?
Right. I mean, and I think, you know, this is with this woman who was named Easter or Esther. Part of the story for me is that, you know, I always thought when I got back to the furthest back ancestor I could trace that it would say born in Africa. In fact, this person was said born in Maryland in 1769, parents born in Maryland, right? So just thinking about her and then also those who came before, having been here for multiple generations, enslaved while the country was being established, right? So what does it mean to be a person who's laboring, probably in tobacco, who is in and doing the kind of labor that builds the wealth of the country and witnessing it being established without her being contemplated. Mm. And so then, you know, we talk about the 3/5 clause of the Constitution, and people, as a sort of easy way, they say, oh, you know, that meant that enslaved people were worth, you know, 3/5. But that's actually not what it meant, because what it meant was just that being a slaveholder meant you got extra representation. They weren't represented at all. They had no votes. They had, you know, they were not contemplated as part of the political community. So it really just meant that people who owned other people had greater political representation. The country began with their property amplifying their citizenship. So then when we talk now about, you know, money and politics, it's not astonishing that there are people with more, their citizenship gets amplified. That was written into the Constitution, you know. And then on the other side, what does it mean to tell us a history from the position of someone who was not contemplated but had been here and whose parents had been here, right? That I think is important. You know, those who were here and were positioned outside from the beginning, that's an important frame for thinking about the American project, or even the idea of what does it mean to be American.
Well, and you go to a number of museums in the South, you know, and that's where we tell our stories, right? I mean, that's where, you know, so there's a docent or there's someone there who's been trained to tell the story. I remember going to Monticello and, they talked about Sally Hemings and they talked about, you know, and I have to say the houses where the enslaved people lived, you know, look rather nice, I think, compared to what they probably actually really look like. And so, it was inclusive, but it was so Disney-fied, if I can put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the experiences I went to this sort of historic home in Maryland, and it was another one of those experiences where I knew I hadn't been considered as a possible guest, which it doesn't happen at Monticello. I didn't go to Monticello and Mount Vernon, partially because so many people had written about those beautifully, but also because I decided I wanted to think outside of the formal history. But there was a docent who started talking about, you know, the mean old bad Indians, right? And I was like, gosh, like, you know, sort of unbelievable to me that was seen as an as an appropriate form of invitation, right? But then she was nervous about it. She's like, I'm sorry, I have to talk about slavery. And she whispered. And I'm thinking, well, but that's not, you know, it's not like I'm not aware of the issue of slavery. So it was fascinating to see up close the awareness of what people are seeking can be very different from the history that I think we need to uncover. I guess that's the simplest way to say it.
And how did you understand her discomfort? I mean, it's almost like the S word, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think many people assume that there is shame attached to having been descended from enslaved people, which for me couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, for me, it's a point of incredible pride in sort of the kind of resilience of my ancestors, but also the refusal, you know, the resistance, right? And not to be, I would be far more ashamed actually to sort of have to grapple with being descended from slave owners. But I think that is actually the assumption that that's a source of shame is also part of the kind of general disrespect that I think is at the heart of so much racism in this country, right? That you're born to a status of degradation is seen as actually meaning something, like that means some kind of inferiority. And so she's whoever she is, but it was a meaningful piece of information because we don't talk about that part, you know, of how we deal with the history of slavery and Jim Crow.
Here are a couple of comments. One from Phil saying, you mentioned that interracial love, understanding, and living in close proximity will not change racism in this country. Structural change is needed. And then Phil says, what do you think about CRT, critical race theory, in education affecting that change? I mean, can that help bring us together?
Well, what I'll say is I used to be a legal academic, so I have a very particular notion of critical race theory, which is based upon an approach to reading constitutional law cases by and large. So as far as I've never heard of critical race theory being taught anywhere in any K-12 school. I just don't know of the examples. They might be. I think most of the critical race theory conversation is actually people talking about the history of race and racism. Mm-hmm. In schools. And I think it's complicated, frankly. I think it's good to teach the history of race because it's just it's a big part of our national history. It can be done poorly with good intentions. It can be done poorly with bad intentions. And so it's hard to make a blanket assessment. I am, though, generally opposed to banning entire subject matters from our history, right? That seems to me to be completely contradictory to the purposes of education, which are to allow our children to be knowledgeable and expansive and actually be able to have the kind of moral imagination to build the best society that could possibly exist. So I'm against the sort of banning of CRT. I don't know what people mean, frankly, when they talk about CRT in schools, though. I just don't think it happens in the way that it's being described.
So what do you think about Black History Month?
I love Black History Month, but it also gets done poorly. I mean, you know, I've written a lot about Black History Month. The way that I know it and have studied it is it the way that it became integral first as Negro History Week in schools in the segregated South, and that it was a ritual. And it was a ritual, you know, that was formalized in 1926. But before that, you know, teachers would do Black history forms of celebration in that period between the birthdays of Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. And then it gets formalized, and it is actually a way to produce a counter narrative to the official narratives of, of the larger school systems or the larger society. And it was really important, right? It's not incidental that the first sit-ins happened in the month where people celebrated Black history, right? The lunch counter sit-ins. These things happen for a reason. So, So I'm supportive of it. You know, it's not what it is in the larger society, from, you know, the corporate commercials to the sporting events. It's not the same thing as the tradition. It's like everything else, right? When it becomes a kind of commercial, it loses some of its heart and soul. but I do think it's an important ritual. It's an important counter argument about what role Black people have played in this country and in the world, because from the beginning it was an international holiday. In a celebration, but yeah.
No, I appreciate that. Let me just throw something else on the table for our discussion. President Biden, when he was candidate, made a promise, campaign promise, to nominate a Black woman to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he says he will do that very soon. There were mixed responses, but let me get Ted Cruz called it offensive and an insult to Black women. Other people felt like this is an affirmative action nomination. What do you make of the reaction to his promise, Biden's promise, but also his saying, I'm going to make good on this promise?
So I will say, I think the reaction is, this conservative reaction has been by and large quite racist, right? Because so much of it has been predicated on this assumption that she will there necessarily be inferior. And as someone who has had colleagues essentially say the same sort of things about my hiring at my first job, and even more recently, there's some colleagues, who I don't know personally, but at Princeton, so both at Rutgers and Princeton, that formulation, well, this will be insulting because this person will obviously not be competitive. They're obviously not skilled. I just think it's racist. Now, I will say, I am always hesitant about overreading representation, right? So it will have symbolic significance, but in the measure of what's going on, I'm more alarmed by the erosion of voting rights than invested in the question of whether there's going to be a Black woman on the Supreme Court, right? And I don't mean to suggest that it's not important, but we have to be careful when we invest so much in representation, visually speaking, when the democratic part of representation seems to be slipping out of our grasp. And that sort of Black voters don't actually have their votes counting. That to me is more alarming.
About a minute before I say goodbye, this issue though will come before the U.S. Supreme Court, this issue of voting rights.
It absolutely will, and let's see what happens with the current composition of the court.
We're almost out of time here, and I had so many more passages I wanted to either quote from or have you read from, but you say, if America is to be salvific, and I had to look that up, lead to salvation, it can only be so because underneath our skyscrapers lie the people who have tasted the red clay, the loamy soil, and you go on from there. Any final thoughts in 20 seconds or less, Imani Perry?
Yeah. Well, I just want to say thank you so much. And I always, want the book to function as an invitation to engage deeply in these questions and to sort of feel the heartbeat and the blood and the soil for readers. So I just appreciate you taking the time with me and all the readers for taking time.
Absolutely. Well, we always enjoy talking with you, Imani Perry, on Radio Time. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care, Marty.
You too. And again, she's the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. And her new book, we've been talking about, South to America, A Journey Below the Mason-Dixon to Understand the Soul of a Nation. To replay this hour and many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.